Welcome to On the Table with Ashley, a podcast where I explore ways in which we can lead more fulfilling lives and amplify human connection by increasing our curiosity, listening, and communicating with less judgment and more respect. It's my pleasure to welcome Jennifer Golbus to On the Table. Jennifer is the co-founder of Meet Me, a coaching and wellness company that she started with her lifetime friend, Jennifer Overbow. Jennifer has run two successful communications businesses, and she is my sister. I can say that Jennifer seems to have been born for interpersonal dialogue. I remember Jennifer making her case with our parents from a young age about whatever the topic du jour was, from getting a full set of drums to practice on in the house, she did, to how much makeup she could wear, a lot, to how late she could stay out. This one, I think they didn't budge that much on. All joking aside, as an adult, Jennifer went through an extremely difficult phase of her life and made it through what she calls the darkness of addiction. In her recovery from alcoholism, Jennifer embraced the role of mentor for women ready to make a positive change in their lives. She believes wholeheartedly in the power of women helping women after experiencing its remarkable power to affect change in her own life. A self-titled recovering perfectionist with former self-sabotage expertise, Jennifer is committed to helping others identify their blocks, change their inner dialogue, and bolster their strengths. She uses a combination of empathy, humor, tough love, and proven tactics to help people find their happiness again. When she's not coaching, you can find her on the beautiful trails of Marin County, California, parenting her two teenagers or obsessively working to perfect her gluten-free cookie recipe. You can find Jennifer at meetmesolutions.com and Jennifer at meetmesolutions.com for email. Jennifer, thank you for joining me today.
Wow, thank you. And it's just that introduction. I don't know if I can live up to all that, Ash, but thank you.
So Jennifer, my first question is generally about where you grew up and what kind of child you were and what you liked to do when you were young. Of course, I know the answers to these questions, but would love our listeners to hear from you. So can you share a little bit about that?
Well, sure. I grew up in Marin County, which is in the San Francisco Bay Area. And I feel like I had a pretty idyllic childhood. I've been talking about this with even my kids recently about I grew up in the 70s. We grew up on a dead end street playing kick the can and sardines and running that whole running around till it gets dark and then you come in for dinner. So that's kind of how I remember my young childhood. I remember being a pretty exuberant kid. I was always smiling, lots of laughter, a little bit mischievous. I always had this little mischievous streak, kind of pushing the envelope, seeing what I could get away with. Certainly, you alluded to in my teenage years, a little bit argumentative. I was like, you know, getting ready with those skills to get what I wanted. You were working on my future communications business.
Exactly.
To me. That's kind of what I remember. Does that fit?
Yeah, that fits for sure. And then maybe you can talk a little bit because you have an identical twin sister, mm-hmm. Lisa, and you and Lisa and Jen Overbow, with whom you've started Meet Me.
Yes.
I mean, my recollection is that you were always the three of you together, either at our house or at their house. She was always over for dinner. So maybe you could just talk. I think it's a little bit unique. You could just talk a little bit about that.
Yes. Thank you so much for saying that, because you're right. Jen and Lisa and I, and we called Jen precisely because we grew up across the street on a dead end block. So I was always Jennifer and she was Jen. That way we always knew who we were talking about. But we have a really unique friendship and we feel so lucky. We've been friends for 50 going on years. I'm dating now, you know how old I am. But Jen and Lisa and I, we even have little nicknames for each other and we have a little text thread to this day with our nicknames. And it's more like a sister at this point than a friend, because our friendship has stood the test of time. And what was interesting is that we never went to school together. We were always in different schools, but we lived near each other. And in that time that I described where you just go out and play, we would always just be, either she was at our house, we were at her house. And it's actually the name of our business that you already mentioned, which is Meet Me. It hails back to those days, obviously way predating cell phones, right? Or texting. We would call each other and say, meet me in the middle of the street. And that was code. Really, it became like, I need to talk. And we would, there was a little designated spot. And again, because it was a dead end street, we could literally sit in the middle of the street. But there was a little like circle. We would just sit there. And that lasted from obviously we weren't calling each other at 2 years old, but from little kids all the way through high school, we would do that.
It's amazing. And you'll talk a little bit more about Meet Me later, but I think it's so cool that one, you three have stayed close all of this time and that you and Jen have started this business and are, you know, still so close today. And maybe just now you can talk about Jen's background, because I think that the combination of your background and Jen's background for your business is totally amazing.
Yeah. And also, because you're right, you asked about me being a twin. So I'll just say something about that for a minute, which has shaped my identity. I have an identical twin sister. Her name is Lisa. We grew up looking so much alike. People would make all those silly twin jokes about how do you know who you are when you wake up in the morning? Really talented questions like that. But and to this day, we still look quite alike. And so that's been, as both of us have grown, or I can only speak for myself, growing into my own identity, that I am not my twin, I am me, but we have a very special bond also to this day. And we bring that also into our relationship with Jen, but also separately. So with Jen, she has a background as a therapist, and she's done trauma, she's led groups, she's worked one-on-one. Right now, currently, she takes her amazing talents into the public school system, working in special education. I'm always joking, they have the most overqualified person on their team up there in the Rockland School District near Sacramento. So that's her background. And then my background, as you mentioned, and we'll talk a little more, but I have a background in communications, but I also have a personal journey into the world of recovery, recovering from alcoholism. So I've developed my own tools of what has helped me make a pretty massive transformation in my own life. But combining that with Jen's more formal training as a therapist, and what we've done is we've combined those two backgrounds into a unique, what we think is a unique coaching platform, where it's called Meet Me, Find Your Best Self. But we talk about bringing a best friend vibe into coaching, because we want to be really authentic, really relatable. And we also want people to feel like it's a safe place, but also super practical tools that actually work. And you know, it's not like therapy where you need to spend a whole bunch of time in order to start getting some results.
Yeah. Well, why don't you, if you could talk a little bit about what you think led you into the field of communication and coaching, and how your expertise in communications has helped with your coaching work, in addition to what we're going to, you know, spend a lot of time talking about, which is your sobriety journey. And then maybe you could talk a little bit as well about how you work with individuals through Meet Me. And we could talk a little bit about that as well.
Yeah, it's so interesting when you, so I'll say the reason what led me into communications was that, like we kind of joked about earlier, I've always just naturally been a communicator, and I know how to make my case. I found writing to be a natural skill when I was in high school and in college and beyond. I had people tell me, "Oh, you have a way with words." I never studied specifically how to be a writer, but it just came really naturally to me. So I found myself in the field of communications, specifically PR and more traditional media relations. And then over the years, that's morphed into communications and marketing communications. It's also because I've always been a people person. I'm an extrovert. I get energy from people. I love talking to people. I find it really interesting and uplifting to connect with people. So the combination of those two things made communications a natural career for me. I never thought so much about the combination of communications and coaching. I actually always kind of felt like I missed my calling a little, even though I'm very good at communications and I'm proud of the work I do there. There's always been this inside little voice saying, this isn't it. There's something else. And I've always wanted to help people. I've always just wanted to be in a field where I'm helping people. So stepping into the role of coach feels like I'm really coming home to what I was really put here to do, if you will, because I believe that we all have a path and the path can change. And to circle back to your question, I do think that there is a combination because it's about listening. It's about being able to clearly reflect back. So when I'm with a communications client, it's a lot of it's listening before I then create a strategic communications plan, let's say. With a coaching client, it's really similar in that it's really deep listening and then having a roadmap. So that's how I think they might combine.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense to me. And we at both on this podcast and then with my brand Amatand, like we're so focused on getting people to connect. And part of that is truly listening, because I think a lot of the time we hear, but we don't listen. And I think in order for you to be good at either communications or coaching, you have to be so good at that. And then probably teaching people to do it as well. So why don't you just talk a few minutes about how you and Jen work with clients at Meet Me, and then we'll move on.
Yes, absolutely. Well, we work with clients in a couple of different ways. In general, we have groups and then we also have one-on-one coaching, and how people choose to engage in coaching just really depends on what works best for them. Oftentimes it's actually a combination. So for example, with our one-on-one clients, we might be going through a process with them, but they might jump into like a group Q&A session where some people find that useful to just hear what's going on with other people. Other people, it's a more private journey and just that one-on-one helps. We have a couple of different groups that we run. One is a 6-week program, which is just kind of our basic kind of toolbox for just quickly, starting to feel better. Some of our clients are like in midlife and just feel like, you know, they might not feel like they need therapy, but there's just something missing. They don't quite feel like themselves. It's like, what happened? And so these are super practical tools to kind of start feeling better right away. And what happens a lot of times, and that's a group program. And what happens a lot of times for a lot of people after that is they see kind of what coaching is all about. And then they might want to go a little bit deeper with some one-on-one. We also have some workshops that we run, which is just a one-off, but it lets people kind of get a sense of who we are. So that they could decide if they wanted to engage in a coaching relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, that sounds amazing. I am a big fan of therapy and coaching. So mm-hmm. I feel like everybody could benefit from probably both of those things.
I agree.
So we'll probably talk more about that, but I wanted to move into your journey of what you call the darkness of addiction, and then your journey to sobriety. Mm-hmm. And then, we'll talk about sort of the impact on your life, both personally and then professionally, because I do really feel like it's impacting what you're mm-hmm. doing mm-hmm. professionally. So can you share whatever part of your story that you're comfortable with about your experience with alcoholism, your low point, mm-hmm. and how you worked through that to where you are today?
My journey with alcoholism was a process of an unlayering. After I got sober and had some clarity of thought, I was able to look back and see that, in fact, alcohol had been a problem for quite a bit longer than I had at first either been willing to admit or even realized. Toward the end of my drinking, what was happening is it had become an addiction. So it was for me I was hiding it, or at least I was trying to. So what began, I'll start, like, I live in California, right? And I live in Northern California near the wine country. So I'm not, it's a very cultural, people drink wine, fine wine, and not, that's not bad. Like, I would say like 90% of the population can drink alcohol with impunity. It does not bother them. About 10% is the going number are have a problem with alcohol. But here where I live, it's very natural and normal to have wine every day with dinner, after work, meet a friend for a glass of wine, go wine tasting in Sonoma or Napa. And just to rewind, my first business that you mentioned in that beautiful intro was a wine industry PR firm. So I started a company with an amazing partner, Michelle Armour, many, many years ago. She still runs it and she's amazing, but we did wine industry PR. Now, looking back, what an amazing career for a budding alcoholic, right? I mean, I'm not saying everyone who does PR for wineries has a problem, but I did. And so as it became a problem, it was really easy to tell myself, this is normal. I'm just tasting my client's wine. It's fine wine. I could, you know, wax poetic about the wine. So as I started drinking more and more to relieve stress or whatever I told myself, it crossed what I think of as an invisible line and got to the point where I could no longer control my drinking, but I was still able to tell myself that it was normal. And then it got worse and worse from there. So,
how was that, years or was that months? That was, you know, that process up years. Until like,
yeah, it was years. Yeah. I mean, if okay. I look
and
back,
then, like, do you think it was in college or it was post-college when you started the wine business?
Oh, I think it started in college. I think it probably started the first time I ever had a sip of alcohol. It's like, what I'm able to admit now is, like, I always loved the effect alcohol had on me. You know, it felt like this wash of, you know, of relaxation. I run a little, like, type A. It was like, my to-do list is too long. I've always got too much going
on.
And so for me, wine was like, oh, I could turn my brain off and have a real, and that's not bad. It's just that it became a crutch,
right?
And turned into something else. So in sobriety, I've had to learn how to give myself relaxing time, allow myself self-care. Right. How do I, you know, switch between work at the end of the evening and go into my personal time without, you know, taking a sip of alcohol to kind of help me make that transition?
Right. Which are skills that we all need. But I think, you know, you had sort of you were using something that was very unhealthy for you to get there.
Right.
So then, and I know that Alcoholics Anonymous was extremely helpful and still is extremely helpful for you. So when did you, was there like something that happened where you decided to go to Alcoholics Anonymous?
Yes. yes, there was an incident, but it was still an unraveling. I had what we call contempt prior to investigation. I did not know anything about the 12 steps other than what you hear in movies or, you know, cultural references, but still I thought it was weird, bad. I didn't want to go. I didn't want to have anything to do with it. What happened was I was drinking during the day. I got in my car to go pick up my, I think they were three back then, three-year-old, four-year-old twins from preschool. And thank God I didn't make it. I crashed my car into a parked vehicle and it was awful. And again, thank God I didn't make it to the preschool, but that was the beginning of the unraveling of the denial that, you know, things have to get pretty darn bad for you to be drinking during the day and go pick up your own children and put them in danger, you know, by putting them in a car. So, so for me, that started a journey of trying everything but AA. I tried an outpatient program that didn't work. It might for some people. I think there are many roads to recovery, by the way. I'm not one of those people who thinks it's 12 steps
right
or best. It's just what worked for me. And I believe in it because it's a wholesale way, a program that helps change your life or changed my life. So I tried therapy. I tried hypnosis. I tried every other group I could find. I pretty much went kicking and screaming to AA. And by the way, when I got there, I did not want to stop drinking forever. I just knew that I had to right then because my life was falling apart.
And how long that journey with hypnosis and therapy and all of these other things that you tried, was that like months of trying things before you went to your first AA meeting?
I would say I went to my first AA meeting as part of my outpatient that required it. I just kind of like grabbed a seat. You know, I wasn't really participating.
Yeah.
I went here and there. I never actually worked the steps. I just went to meetings and those are not the same thing.
And then what changed?
What happened for me is that I didn't even understand what was happening to me. It was so baffling. It was so upsetting. I was so filled with shame. I couldn't stop it. I couldn't understand it. And then people would ask me, well, why can't you stop? I would just remember just crying and going, I don't know. What is wrong with me? I was going to therapy. I couldn't even understand what was happening in my own self. So I wrote an essay that's going to be published in February 28th.
Great.
It's called Love Notes from the Soul. And when I wrote this essay, it's about my journey into recovery and sobriety. It helped me kind of think through how that felt. And I'll just read this.
Yep.
Is that okay?
So please do. The title of your essay is This Baffling Beautiful Life.
Yes.
And hopefully after it publishes, we can put a link to it in the show notes.
I'll have that soon.
I think it's a very courageous essay, and I think it will help a lot of people. So please go ahead and read that excerpt. And then I do want to come back and talk a little bit more about AA and like how you bought in and how
that process absolutely
unfolded. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so this is a short excerpt from This Baffling Beautiful Life from the Love Notes from the Soul anthology. The AA Big Book warns, remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful. I find these adjectives to be spot on. Cunning. It's smarter than I am. It whispers to me in my own voice, telling me to pop in at the grocery store to buy butter so that I can demonstrate my love for my children from scratch chocolate chip cookies. When what it really wants is to get me into the store so that I see those mouth-watering displays of Chardonnay and walk out with a bottle. That literally happened to me one time. Baffling, the very definition of having no idea what is happening to you and why, despite your ability to achieve everything else in the course of your life that you have ever set your mind to, including swimming across the Golden Gate Bridge, true story, teaching a class on the Holocaust to peers in high school and starting a thriving business during a recession, why you are utterly incapable of stopping the insanity, even though you are destroying your life and putting your children in danger. And powerful. This thing is so powerful that not even the love of a mother for her children is strong enough to defeat it. This brutal truth was such a blow to my identity as a mother that it took me years to move through the shame and forgive myself. And I'll stop there. I know that's a heavy place to stop, but that's why I've made a decision to live out loud with my sobriety and learn to hold my head high. And I know, because I know what it feels like to have to be a mother who's like, how do you do that? How do you hold your head high again? And I want to help other people know that, yes, you can hold your head high, because that wasn't really you. That was the disease.
Yes, absolutely. And we'll talk about shame some more too. I'm actually going to read one other excerpt from your essay.
Oh boy.
That really, just really touched me. So you wrote, I watched the whispers, I'm like going to cry. I watched the whispers of my husband with his parents through the kitchen window and understood he might leave me. I pictured myself living alone in an apartment with visitation rights for my own children, who were the sunlight of my existence. And I knew I wouldn't want to live if that became my reality. And yet I drank. And I think it's just such a beautiful and, again, like very courageous way of saying, like, this, whatever this thing is, it took hold of you and it is not your fault, but you had to do really hard work to move through it to sobriety. And I want you to talk a little bit about how hard that work was. And I think you've said very, you know, effectively, like AA is certainly not the only way people can move through alcoholism. And I also want to note, I think this conversation is relevant to people who are not, don't have a drinking problem, but they may have some other kind of addiction and, or they do something excessively. And it could be, I mean, it really could be anything. They could work excessively and not have time for their family. They could have problem with their weight and they could eat excessively and that could cause shame and other physical problems. Like there are so many problems that I think we as humans face. And I think your story can help all of these people. So can you talk a little bit about when you finally said, yes, I'm going to give this a try. I know it still took a very long time and a lot of work. And I believe that work goes on for the rest of your life. But can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I'd love to. You're right. When I finally went for real to AA and said, I'm going to work the steps, which you get with what we call a sponsor. And all that means is somebody who's walked through the steps already. And the steps is a program of recovery. That's all they are. It's like suggestions that you, it's suggested that you take so that you can recover from alcoholism or whatever other addiction, as you mentioned, because yes, this can help all of that kind of behavior and get your life back. What happened for me is because my denial had been so deep and so strong for so long, it took me 3.5 years as a member of AA before it actually really took hold. And what I mean by that is that I never had another drink again. And I recently, just last year, celebrated 10 years of continuous sobriety, which was like double digits. It was amazing. And I've been on the journey for 13.5 years, right? Because I started and then I was what called relapse, just means I took a drink.
Want to stop right there. So for 3.5 years, you were working this program and you kept relapsing. I think it's really important for people to hear that. And I don't know if there's statistics on like, if there's like an average period of time, but I think it's actually, it sounds strange, but in some ways comforting to know that it actually takes a long time because then you can stop beating yourself up if you're not like immediately solving a problem.
That's
like, this is hard work and it takes time and it's like 2 steps forward, 1 step back. So I just wanted to,
there's a saying in AA, we say, don't quit before the miracle, just don't quit because, it takes what it takes. And there's another saying that I do want to share because it doesn't have to take that long. And relapse does not have to be part of your story, anyone's story. It's part of mine. Is that sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. It just takes what it takes. And I now can look back and see that I never tried to stop drinking before I got to AA. I didn't think I had a problem. Like we discussed with the cultural and the wine and I started trying to stop as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Other people who get there have, you know, tried all kinds of things to stop and they get there really desperate and are like, oh my God, help me. I don't want to ever drink again. I remember when people told me, you never have to drink again. I wanted to like, be like, is that supposed to help me? Like, I wanted to drink so badly. I was so angry. I didn't want to give it up. It was my solution.
Yeah.
It was my solution to everything that ailed, or so I thought. So I it took me, that was just my path. And yes, it was very hard to keep going in and admitting that I had drunk again, because one of the tenets of being able to get sober, but I would say to make any real lasting change in your life, is honesty. Yeah. So it's, again, nobody was saying, Jennifer, you have to tell, but if I didn't, I was going to keep drinking. You've probably heard the saying, you're only as sick as your secrets. But if for an alcoholic like me, if I keep a secret, especially a big secret like that, it's like, I'm going to drink. I just am. I've seen it over and over. And I've seen, you know, friends in the program. Also, when you keep a secret, you end up drinking because you're like taking your will back. And part of getting sober is kind of letting go and understanding that you need to plug into a source of energy that's bigger than you. Yeah. Because look where I got myself. I couldn't stop by myself, yeah. Not even for my kids. Yeah.
And so what does it mean to you today, now that you're 10 years sober, that saying, you never need to drink again?
Now it feels like such a relief.
Yeah.
It's no longer my solution, right? Yeah. It's just not. And I still, to this day, you know, 10 plus years into my recovery journey, first of all, I still go to meetings because I want to, because I'm surrounded by people who are looking for what I call solution. Good meetings, 12-step meetings, are not about like complaining about your hard week and how hard your life is. No, there is absolutely a place for that. And for people who are new, that's also why we have meetings, is to allow a safe space where other people can truly relate to what you're going through. Because there's nothing you can tell me that will shock me or that I haven't heard. I can really relate. And it's a place where we're like, okay, so what tool are you going to use? It's people seeking a way of life that is connected, that's about adding to life. I took so many years taking, complaining, feeling sorry for myself, crying, you know, messing things up. I'm done with that. I now am looking to see what I can add. And so when you're surrounded by other people who are also seeking to live the best life they can, literally today, tomorrow, and bringing like, hey, this is a challenge I'm walking through, I need a little support, it's really empowering.
Yeah.
So I've walked through some pretty hard things in sobriety, and it still to this day, Ashley, makes me, I partly don't really understand it, how I don't want to drink.
Yeah.
It's no longer my solution.
Yeah. Yeah. Can you tell us what you think the definition of alcoholism is? And maybe we can pair this with a discussion. This was a question that you, or a topic that you had recommended, which is talking about like moms who drink.
Mm-hmm.
And it's related, I think, to the topic of shame, which we're also going to get into. Mm-hmm. I'd like to get into. And I know, and I read a lot during COVID, like a lot of people, but a lot of more women and moms actually started using alcohol as a coping mechanism during mm-hmm. a very stressful time. And I'm sure for many of them, when the stress died down, they stopped, but maybe for some of them, they didn't. So, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So how do you know if it's a problem or if it's just like a coping mechanism for some period of time? Or is there a definition that you feel in your heart is like the definition?
So Ash, I think that's a really important distinction. And if there's anyone listening who's wondering, oh, I think I'm, you know, maybe drinking too much. Do I have a problem? Am I an alcoholic? Here is my definition of alcoholism. And again, this is just my experience and my what I've learned is, and alcoholism is when you lose the ability to control your drinking. Here's what I mean by that. Let's say someone during the pandemic started drinking more, and you're right, read all those articles. Oh, people are drinking more. Understandable. Here's the difference. If you have that self-awareness and you go, hey, I think I'm kind of drinking too much. I'm going to cut back. You know, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to maybe not drink during the week, and then I can have some drinks on the weekend. Or I'm going to have 2 glasses a night, but then stop. Whatever it is, you make a plan, and it's easy. Easy peasy lemon squeezy to stick to the plan. You are not an alcoholic. You still can control your drinking. You might be just choosing to have a few glasses because it took the edge off and made you feel better. An alcoholic cannot stick to that for any extended period of time, or if they can, because there are people who we call it white knuckling. Like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to show everyone I'm going to show myself I don't have a problem. But you got to watch your mind. If you are obsessing about it, if you are always thinking about it, if you can't wait till your next drink, if you have that second glass, put the bottle away, and then you're like, you need to distract yourself, you might have a problem with alcohol. So okay. To me, it's not as much about how much you drink. It's about your ability to control it and your like obsession with it and feeling uneasy when you're trying to maybe control it.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. Thank you for giving us your definition. I want to talk about shame. You suggested that we talk about this topic, and I'm so glad you did. I think it's a powerful and destructive force. Mm-hmm. And honestly, I think none of us is exempt from feeling shame. And I think that it requires active work to deny or push away or however you would define it. And again, mm-hmm. I would say, while this is a discussion about alcoholism and addiction, I think that shame is actually, you know, can spread across our lives in so many ways and so many destructive ways. So I think it's a really important topic, like very broadly speaking.
Yes.
And so whether it's shame disgust or disappointment directed at ourselves for whatever the habit or the action or whatever it is, I think we can see this in so many aspects of our lives, whether it's not adhering to a diet that we set out upon, not being able to lose the weight we want, even knowing that it's important for our health, drinking too much or using some other substance, not being as good of a parent, partner, or child as we want to be, letting people down when we're at work mm-hmm. or in our community. The list literally just can go on and on. I also spent a lot of time thinking about this when I was working at Juul, which was the e-cigarette company, and you know my journey there. So I think that a lot of people may not realize it, but many addicted smokers have a huge amount of shame for their habit. And I think it may be similar to what you were just talking about in the definition of alcoholism. It's like a lot of smokers that I talked to when I worked at Juul were like, I want to stop, I just can't stop. I know it's bad for me. I just can't stop doing it. I know that I'm likely to put like a burden on family members who will have to care for me later. And I still can't stop. Right. It's a big part of the reason that I joined Juul to help people do something positive in their lives. And I still think it's an incredibly important option for addicted smokers. Obviously a very complicated subject. Kids should not be using it. Full stop, and a discussion for another time. But I do think that giving people options for dealing with shame is an incredibly, or tools, maybe I should say, is a better word, is incredibly, incredibly important. And a lot of the time, there's a huge, I think, societal element. So on the episode with Dylan Williamson about using they, them pronouns and about being transgender, we talked a lot about societal norms. And I think there's a lot of room for a lot more discussion on this. Mm-hmm. And I think both alcoholism and nicotine addiction fall into this, where it's like, oh, totally normal for you to go to Napa and to love to drink wine. But society says, well, why can't you just stop? And like, why do you have a problem? Just stop drinking. And they say the same thing to addicted smokers, like, you know, it's bad for you, just stop. And it's just not that easy. And I think with so many things in our lives, like, it's just not that easy. You know, it's like, yes, we should go to the, we should all wake up at 6 a.m. and go to the gym for our health. But, you know, it's not always that easy. So, also in the discussion that I had with Dylan, I read following that discussion, the book that Dylan recommended called Beyond the Gender Binary by Alok Ved Menon, who's a non-binary activist. And this is what they said about shame. This is how shame works. It recruits you into doing its work for you. And I thought that was so well said. It feels so true to me. We need to learn how not to succumb to shame. We need to learn not to let shame have power over us. I think some of this is finding our own truth and our own power and our own story and like being willing to live that story. But can you talk, and I know this is a very long-winded beginning or question, but can you talk about how you confronted shame in your addiction to alcohol and what helped you move through it to be able to like see it? Oh, this is shame and I am going to not let it have power over me.
Mm-hmm. First of all, that quote, oh my gosh. It's interesting to personify shame in that way. It's just, I'm going to answer your question, but I wanted to say that sometimes I picture my alcoholism as a personified entity, if you will, because you know how earlier I said that it's smarter than me, cunning, baffling, and powerful. It's stronger than me. And so when I'm in, you know, doing my work of recovery, going to meetings, doing my, you know, doing what I do, I picture it over there in the corner doing push-ups, waiting. It's so still there. It's just, I'm like, you're not invited to this party.
Yeah.
You know, but if I don't stay strong, it could come back. So I'm in recovery. It's not gone though. And so to hear you talk about shame personified like that, that it kind of, it has an agenda and it's getting us to do its work for it. That's really powerful. Okay. So I'm going to answer your question about shame. It's a big one. I don't think we're going to be able to get to the bottom of it, but I'll say it's like, we could do like hours on shame. First of all, I think you talked about societal norms, and I know this is a little bit of a cliche, but I think this is really important. We tend to judge compare our insides with other people's outsides. This is the basis, I think, this comparison, especially in the world of social media where it's so curated. Instagram, Facebook, all of it. Most of us put our curated lives up for the internet world to see, right? And then we wake up, we're crying because we can't find the right outfit to wear because we gained 20 pounds, or our kids are like, we can't get our kids buckled into the car seat because they're having tantrums. And then there's somebody going, oh, look at my beautiful, perfect kid. It's just not real life. And I always like to think every human has a struggle. It just is the case. Maybe they're doing great right now, but they've worked through something we all do. So there's a tendency I see in myself and others to think she's got it figured out. He's got it all together. I still catch myself doing this. Why do I struggle with, fill in the blank, you know? And then we convince ourselves that somebody else has got it all figured out. And I think that is a hotbed for shame, because then we get to should on ourselves. I should be better. I should have done this. They have it together. Why don't I? And so the other thing that I want to say on this is the flip opposite, okay, is that never judge a person by their appearances. It's that old, don't judge a book by its cover.
Yeah.
You remember me, I was really pretty good until maybe the very end. It's almost like I had a double life. I looked like a mom who was an amazing mom who was bringing their kids to school. I was going to committee meetings. I was running a business. You would never know my life was falling apart on the inside. So we just need to worry about ourselves. Easier said than done. The other thing that I think is important when we're thinking about shame is looking at how we talk to ourselves, our own inner critics. We all have one. Some people even name theirs.
Yeah.
It's kind of useful too, because then you can like separate yourself from that inner voice. Our thoughts and what we think are so powerful. And this goes a little bit, it's like a little bit bridging into how we coach and meet me.
Yeah.
But I know it sounds a little bit like popular psychology a little bit, but it's really not. It's based in science. Our thoughts create our realities. They just do. Here's how it works.
Your subconscious... I 100% agree.
And once I've studied it a little bit, our subconscious doesn't actually know the difference between reality and what we tell it. It just takes what we tell it at face value. So when we think something, I suck, I'm so awful, I can't stop drinking or smoke, whatever it is, our subconscious believes that and then keeps feeding us. It's almost like Google. Like we Google, show me all the reasons why I suck. And then our brain happily complies. And that is so if we can catch ourselves with the thoughts that we're thinking, it will have a cascading effect. Now, but I want to say a caveat, that's a lot harder to do than it sounds. And so a lot of times we need help, either a coach, a therapist, a group, you know, something to help us. For me, with shame, it's about self-worth a lot. For me, it was about self-worth. And my self-worth was just absolutely non-existent when I started in AA. I would look at myself in the mirror and like yell at myself. I mean, it is so sad, but I couldn't, like I already said, I couldn't understand what was wrong with me and why I couldn't just stop. So I thought I was just kind of the worst mother ever to walk the earth, a despicable person. My self-worth just went in the tank. It was tanked. So you asked what we can do. Because shame really comes from feeling like so small, like you're just not worthy of, I just keep saying holding my head high, because as a sober, dignified woman today, I can hold my head high. And when I started, I couldn't. So one thing that I tell a lot of my clients is that you can build self-esteem little by little. It's going to take time by doing esteemable acts. You build self-esteem by doing esteemable acts. What's an esteemable act? That's going to be different for everybody. It depends on what you have shame around. But one universal thing that I used to do, because I was so absorbed in my own problems that I had lost the ability to connect with other people, really. So one of the things that was suggested to me was to call 3 people a day. I called women to start. Now I call all people. But I would call 3 women a day to check in on them, not to complain about my life, but to add something to their day. I will tell you that small act, I'm going to go back to doing it this week. I'm going to tell you how it goes. It builds up your self-esteem, because think about like how you feel when you give someone a gift.
Yeah.
Do you ever feel like it's more fun for you as the giver than it is as the receiver?
I love giving gifts. Yeah.
Right? So look how big I'm smiling just thinking about it. It's like when you call someone to say, hey, I was just thinking about you, just checking in. How often do you receive a call like that?
Yeah.
Not very often, right? Hmm? So it's a beautiful way to A, build connection. And it makes you feel so good because you were doing something for somebody else. And it's just so simple. I will tell you that when I was doing this and I was thinking about who would I like to call, my intuition would lead me to call somebody. And I cannot tell you how many times they would say, I was just crying, or I was just having such a hard day. You made my whole day. So that's one idea. It's just an amazing tool. The other thing is, there's a saying in AA that says, we do not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. Okay, so that's like, it's a pretty tall order to not regret the past if you have done something that you're ashamed of, that you're feeling shame. So just know it's going to take time. And if you keep working on it, you will get to the point where you can see that what you think you regret and is causing pain in the past is actually going to help you help people in the future. Yeah, but I think it's about self-worth and self-esteem. And most people are going to need help with it. It's not easy to do on your own.
Yeah. Well, I think those are a couple of really good tips. I'm a believer that things happen for a reason. So I think that you were meant to go through this journey so that you can help people now mm-hmm. through your coaching company. And both on this podcast and with my brand, Amatand, I'm endeavoring to encourage people to become curious about more around them, but also, you know, this discussion is like within them. And I think, you know, we want to talk a lot about topics that people either don't understand or don't agree with, and then how to engage in a curious, respectful way. And I think this conversation is really about the conversation within. And, and so maybe you can share a few tips from your sort of joint expertise in communications and coaching on how you can start doing this. And maybe it's to look at your website and reach out to you. And so maybe people can start with like these couple of things, like contact 3 people a day or that sort of a thing. But if they want something more, you know, is it time to, you know, maybe try a coach? And how do you know it's time for me to try a coach? Because I think coaching may be like getting help with an addiction or going to therapy for whatever the reason. Like, you do have to be in a mental space where you're open to it mm-hmm. to, I think, to get, you know, to get whatever out of it you can get. So do you have thoughts on like, when is it the right time to reach out to a coach? Or am I not ready? Is there work I need to do first? And what is that work?
Mm-hmm. Such a good question. It's a simple answer. I think that if you have something you're not happy with in your life, it could be at work, it could be in your personal life, it could be an addiction, it could be, like you said, weight, it could be just you're feeling like you're not yourself and you can't seem to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. It's another cultural like reality that drives me crazy, is this idea that we're supposed to, you know, just kind of figure it out. So right. If there's something that you're not happy with and you are ready to do things differently, then you are ready for a coach.
Okay.
I think you don't need to have done any work on your own. I think it's this whole be coachable, right? I mean, it's like, I had someone say to me in the beginning when I was going through a version of coaching, really in the 12 steps of having somebody mentor me and say, okay, now I suggest you do this. That was really like a version of a coaching relationship where there were suggestions made and I followed the suggestions. When I didn't follow the suggestions, guess what happened? I didn't get better. I drank for 3.5 years, right? So I think that anyone who wants to have something change and is like, I tried it my way. I maybe have tried it, or I just know, or I'm just exhausted and I just don't even know. I wouldn't even know where to start. That's when a coach can really help. And the thing I love about coaching is it's really results oriented. It's really action oriented. It's the other thing I love about AA. It's a program of action. You don't have to understand what's being asked of you. It's important that when you find a coach, you trust them. I mean, it sounds obvious, but you have maybe had a call with them, or they've been on a podcast, or they wrote a book, or they, you know, you have some kind of relatability with them. Because you got to be ready to put aside your own thinking and take the suggestions of your coach. And those are really the two ingredients, I think, that will make a successful coaching relationship.
Okay. And I would think that for people listening, that actually might be comforting. Like, I get to kind of give it up and let somebody else advise me or direct me and try that for a while. Like, that's actually,
yeah, it's like, it's like somebody, a coach of mine once said to me, well, like, doing it your way, how'd that go for you? How's that working for you? you can always go back. She said, like, you are tomorrow.
Exactly.
Jennifer, you are welcome to go back doing it your way, but your way got you here. So I'm just saying, just like, drop the rope and be willing to try it a different way. I think most people who haven't had a coaching relationship would be surprised how gratifying it is, because what I find is that you come for a specific issue usually, or a certain goal. But if you've got a good coach, you're going to end up growing in all areas of your life. It's a personal development journey too. Even if you don't want it to be, you can't help growing when you start trying to do things differently.
Yeah, that totally makes sense to me. Okay, one more question on this whole area of conversation, and then we'll move on a little bit. I often talk about how hearing is not the same as listening. We talked about that a bit earlier. One of our appetizer or cocktail napkins has the phrase, listening is the language of love, because to me, it truly is love or a respect language. And yet I feel it's so often not truly accomplished, and maybe particularly today. Can you share some thoughts on hearing versus listening, and how we can become better listeners?
Oh my gosh, I love you for asking this question. It's one of my pet peeves. People don't listen. Hearing versus listening. Okay. So first of all, my first thought is that, I mean, I totally agree, and I'm totally buying those napkins. That's amazing. But seriously, first of all, we just have to be curious about other people, and for just a moment, stop being so self-obsessed about what we have to say. So one tip is, if you really are, if you're like, oh, I think, feel like I'm not listening well, one tip is to catch yourself. And I was going to, sorry, let me start by saying, be curious. But what I mean by that is, yes, be curious about the other person, but also just about yourself. Stop being so hard. We're so hard on ourselves. So I like to try to be like a neutral observer with myself, and I'll be like, oh, there I go doing that thing again where I, you know, like, just like, I don't have to judge it and be so mean to myself.
Yeah.
What many of us do is we're forming the answer that we're going to sound so smart and so amazing while the other person's talking. Well, you can't really hear what somebody else is saying if in your mind you're like, oh, I know what I'm going to say. Oh, I'm going to this one. And then you're like kind of half listening. Right. So, I mean, that's very typical. And especially now with a lot of, in a boardroom situation at work, you want to sound smart in front of your boss. So you're having a brainstorm session, let's say, and you can't hear what your colleague's saying because you're already thinking about your answer. And the same goes in interpersonal. So that's one thing, is just try to catch yourself doing that. But again, don't be so mean to yourself. Just catch yourself, because then you can go, oh, I'm doing that thing where I'm forming my answer. I'm going to just shut that down and listen. And then curiosity. And then the third tip I have is, somebody said to me once, I never forgot this. Most of us, all of us, let's say all of us, I try to picture everybody walking around with a sign above their head that says, make me feel special. That's really all most of us want, is connection. We want to feel like you care, whoever you are. You could be in line at the grocery store and have a connection with somebody. I do it all the time. And again, guess who gets the benefit? I get the benefit when I make somebody else feel good. I actually have been thinking a lot about our dad, who I feel had an innate skill at this.
Absolutely.
And I hope I don't make you cry, but I actually looked up a speech that I wrote back in 2015. Is about 2 years, one year after he passed. And I was I was honoring him. And I'm going to read this to you as an answer to your question about how can we truly listen.
Okay, you are going to make me cry, but go ahead.
Okay. This was written September 18th, 2015. It says, "You know the concept of being in the moment we all strive to achieve these days? My dad was born knowing how to do that. To sit with Harvey was to have his full attention. He just knew how to be where his feet were." Can we all just think for a moment and imagine how different our world would be if every time we were with another human, we knew the indescribable feeling of being the center of their attention? Isn't that what we all want, to feel important, to feel cared for, and to feel loved? I cherish the memory of that feeling, perhaps most of all. So that was, I was just like thinking about listening, because, you know, Dad had this ability to, like, he was an attorney, he had a thriving business, he had, I mean, he had a busy life. And every time I talked to him, whether it was on the phone or in person, it was like,
yeah,
you know, it was like, only person in the room. And I think if we could all do that for ourselves and for whoever we're talking to, I literally feel like we could heal the world if we would all do that.
I so agree. And I actually remember, you know, in my speech for Dad, talking about one of the same things. And the thing I think that was remarkable is, maybe you would say for your daughter, you would do that, but Dad did it with everyone. And people he would never meet again, people he saw infrequently, it didn't matter. And I remember just the outpouring of love and remembrance that came to me after his passing. And I really think it's because he had that amazing ability to connect with people and make every single person that he spoke with feel like the center of the universe. And it is, I love this like center of the universe kind of concept, for how we can, you know, try to be better listeners. So thanks, Dad.
Thanks, Dad. You know, that just, when you said that, it made me think of, people might not remember what you say, but they will always remember how you make them feel.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So I started the On the Table podcast to coincide with and amplify my brand, Amatand, an elevated everyday tabletop brand with a goal of increasing connectedness among people. So it was such a nice story to have ended our conversation on. Each week, we send our guests a product from our current collection. And Jennifer, I sent you our teal glass carafe and water glasses. I'm so excited to talk about these. As Dylan and I spent months and months designing and iterating on the design of these items. First, we wanted a water or juice glass that was easy to hold in your hand. The gently curved form we ended up with, in my opinion, is just perfect. I use this glass every day for water, and it sits by my bedside table every night. It's lightweight, holds a nice amount of liquid, is comfortable to hold, and stacks nicely. The glass is also designed to sit on top of the carafe to have on a bedside table, a kitchen table, or as you carry it. In addition, the carafe and glasses are dishwasher safe, and I wash mine in the dishwasher all the time. So would love any feedback that you have so far or any improvements you'd like to see as we continue our design of future products.
Oh my gosh. Well, first of all, you've been seeing me for this whole podcast. I'm drinking from this beautiful glass right now. And I brought the carafe here. So, I mean, I've never seen anything quite like this, to be honest. The design is so unique. It's somehow modern, but not, but elegant. Like a lot of times for me, modern design is too angular or almost too simple, and it doesn't have like personality. This carafe is so beautiful. And the glass, it was interesting to hear you say that it was specifically designed so that it's easy. Cause look how I end up holding it like this, or like with my hands underneath or to the side. It's just like very lightweight, which is new for me because my usual water glasses are a little bit heavier. And also as somebody who feels 100 times better when I drink a lot of water and yet struggles to drink my water, I've tried all the things. I have like a water bottle with a straw in it. I've measured like whatever. So what I did is I measured out how many ounces this holds so that it holds 5 8-ounce. It looks small and petite, and yet it holds 5 8-ounce glasses, which is so interesting to me. So if I carry this around with me all day and I drink this whole thing, then there's only a couple more. I have one before with breakfast, one with dinner, and I'm done. So I'm delighted, and I think it's absolutely beautiful. What I haven't done yet is I haven't had company over yet, and I can't wait to put it out and have people like ooh and ah over it, because the teal color is so gorgeous. It's so
pretty. It is a beautiful color. Yeah. Well, thank you. And if you have any other comments as you use it.
I'm just going to show how it fits right on top.
Yeah.
I just had to take my last sip. and then the glasses themselves stack also. My kids are drinking out of them. And I love how you said they're not so precious. I don't have to like worry about my kids drinking like my crystal or something and throw in the dishwasher. You know, I have a busy life. So I would be less likely to get this lipstick stain on it if I knew I had to go hand wash it every time. Oh, God forbid.
Amazing. Thank you.
Yes.
Okay. So every episode, I end the podcast asking the same 5 questions to my guests, and I hope you are game to answer them.
I'm game.
All right. So the first one is, as we explore in my brand, Amatand, objects can hold a lot of meaning for us. They can tie us to the past, enable us to enjoy the present moment more, or even take us into the future. Can you share an object from your life, whether you still have it or not, that holds a lot of meaning for you, and tell us why?
I can, and I've thought about this because I've listened to all of your podcasts and heard you ask this question. I actually brought these. These are my great-grandmother's Shabbat candlesticks. They came all the way from Russia 3-4 generations ago. And at the top, you can see how they are so well used that the silver, these are silver handcrafted candlesticks that I light my Shabbat candles with on Friday nights. And they're melted on the top because they've been used over so many dozens of years. And when I was gifted with these, they're not in the best shape, right? I polish them up and this is the best they can look. I just feel my ancestors with me when I go through when I light my Shabbat candles. And it's like this generations coming into my home that I can sense by these well-loved candlesticks. So that's my item that hold a lot of meaning for me.
That is amazing. Thank you for sharing that. Can you also share a favorite tradition with us? It could be something from when we were kids. It could be something you do with your kids or family or anything in between. It could be revolve around food.
Such a fan of traditions. I have like 20 I want to share. I'm going to pick one. We're really into like food in our family. Everything revolves around like a special food for an occasion. And I'm also really into birthdays. I believe in birthdays. I believe in celebrating the day somebody was brought into this world. And I combine a tradition that you and I have with our dad of donuts. So we won't get into that too much, but to say I've created a new tradition with my kids where on the morning of their birthday, they wake up and I go super early to the donut store and I get a donut And they each have these birthday plates that I literally, they got when they were born. They're like little kid birthday plates. And I still make them use them every year on their birthday. And I put a candle in the donut. And then I give them one gift to unwrap before they go off to school. So we light the candle. We sing happy birthday. It's a donut. It's super fun. They love it. They get to have a present. And then we all go off to our busy days and then whatever else we do for the birthday. So that's my fun tradition. I hope we can always continue and never stop.
So I love that tradition. Have you thought about how you're going to export that to college?
I literally, as those words were coming out of my mouth, was like, damn it, they're going to college next year. Am I going to like drop ship a donut to them? I'm not sure. I'll get back to you on that.
I actually think you should. Let's work on it. We'll work that.
Yes. We'll work on that together.
Okay. I know the answer to this, but are you in a phase in your life where you enjoy entertaining in your home? Why or why not?
You think you know the answer? I'm just kidding.
I think I do.
The answer is yes. And I've always loved entertaining in my home. Why or why not? Like when I lived in a one bedroom apartment, I entertained. When I lived, when I had my twins running amok and my house was messy, I entertained. Now I entertain. I love, it's because life is about connection. Like, why are we here? I have to remind myself because I get really busy too. And so that's why is like, why am I working and, you know, cleaning, like just like getting groceries, like all the things we do, what we're really here is for connection and love and friendship. And I love filling my home with love. So,
can you give us one or two tips for how you entertain? I know you cook a lot. So, and I'm trying to reduce the friction for people. So to make it easier, because I completely agree. The point is just to spend time together. And in good times and in bad times, it's important to spend time together. Yes. In difficult and in easy times, it's important to spend time together. So do you have a tip or two for how you can do it, you know, so frequently?
Yes, I have a couple of tips. The first one is get over the dust bunnies. Like literally nobody cares. In fact, I will go so far as to say that if you do not have a perfectly sparkly clean house, your guests will appreciate you for it because it will give them permission to do the same. We put so much stress on ourselves to make it look perfect. Now, listen, you and I both grew up with a mom who is an amazing entertainer. And I trust me, I love doing it when I do have the time to clean and put the bud vases with the flowers and make it look like, you know, my aspiration always like the combination of Martha Stewart and Barefoot Contessa combined, you know, but the truth is it just does. So that's tip number one. Tip number two is let people bring things. It actually makes people, I feel like a little bit uncomfortable when you're like, no, I got it. And I actually did this recently where I kind of forgot my own advice. I was like, no, I got it. And then it's like, people feel like you did so much work. And they feel kind of bad. So you can make them feel more involved in it and like greatly reduce the stress. It does not even have to be homemade. I've done so many where I go to my favorite burrito place and do like a make your own burrito kind of bar. It's delicious. People love it. All I do is place the order and pick it up. I love cooking. So sometimes I cook. One more thing I want to say as a sober person is I do not entertain with alcohol. And I think this is really interesting. So for anyone listening who is nervous about that, A, I do have many sober friends who entertain with alcohol. Total personal choice. I have made the decision that in my home, it's my safe haven. I do not serve alcohol. And for 10 years, I have had amazing parties, dinner parties, large, small, in between, like all of it, New Year's, birthday, all of it, holidays, no alcohol. And guess what? People aren't there for alcohol. People are there to enjoy a meal, break bread together, so to speak. And it's like, it's about how you make them feel, back to what we talked about. So my last tip is to, even if you're keeping it simple, be ready. And what I mean by that, Have you ever gone to someone's house and they were like stressed and running around and like there was no food out and you were starving and you're like, should I come back? And like, are you, did I get the date wrong? You know, and you feel really, you don't want to feel like you're putting somebody out by accepting an invitation. So even if it was throwing chips in a bowl or carrots and hummus and just like make people feel welcome and like it is your absolute pleasure. You're so happy you're there because you are. And yeah. that's yeah. really the most important thing is to have people yeah. feel like
I agree with that.
Want or want it.
Yeah. And a lot of times, and I feel like it's been a journey for me because I used to want to home cook everything, which just can be super overwhelming to prepare and also get the timing right. So I started to try to do things that can be prepared ahead of time and I can just put in the oven so that when people come, I'm really focused on greeting them and being with them because I really do think that that is so important. And, you know, what you said about having, letting people bring things echoes what another guest, Stephanie Boy, said. It's another amazing episode.
I heard her interview. Yes.
Everybody needs to listen to that episode multiple times. But one of the things that she said on The Entertaining was, yes, allow people to bring things. It makes things so much easier. And her other pro tip was let people help you clean, which is something I intend to do. Because also you feel like, no, I should clean up. I should do it. But if everybody pitches in, it will happen so much faster. And then you can do it with so much more frequency. So I love both of those tips. Okay. Our last question. Oh, actually I have two more. Do you have one or two top resources you can recommend to our listeners? It could be related to communications, coaching, life. It could be your website. It could be a book, your favorite book, anything.
Yeah, there's so many. There's one, it's actually another podcast that I love. Is that, so can I?
Yeah, of course.
To recommend. It's called The Life Coach School. Okay. I'm not a student there, so I'm not getting anything by recommending it. I'm just, the woman's name is Brooke Castillo, and she is so smart and so, tackle so many topics. So for anyone who is just like on a personal development journey, you can listen to her podcast. She tackles things like shame. She tackles things like overeating, but also things like business, everything. And she's great to listen to. And then one of my favorite books is called Success Principles by Jack Canfield. Jack Canfield, wrote, the Chicken Soup for the Soul series and many, many other things. But his Success Principles book has really helped me in my personal development journey and also my journey as an entrepreneur. And then the third thing is Qigong. And there's a couple of websites that I like or YouTube that I go to for free resources to help with that.
Why don't you tell people what that is? Because they may not know what Qigong is.
Yeah, so Qigong, many people have heard of Tai Chi. So that's got that one similar word in it, that same word, Qi. And Qigong is an ancient Chinese modality that combines gentle movement with meditation and visualization.
Okay, awesome. And what do you do for yourself? We've talked a lot about, you know, the importance of that and your journey. So do you have a practice, a focus, a habit, or a daily routine that contributes to your well-being, to your success?
Mm-hmm. Well, I live in Marin County, which is a beautiful part of California with a lot of mountains and hills. And so I love getting out and hiking in nature whenever I can. I meet a friend once a week at 6 a.m. and we go hiking. When it's dark, we don't get up on the mountain because it's literally before the sun rises. But being in nature is one. The other one, though, that I've thought about is a daily routine. And what I have learned is that I had to give myself permission to let that change. Because I hear, again, we've talked about comparing our insides with other people's outsides. And I was like, oh my God, I suck at my morning routine or I can't stick to it. So what I've realized is that it's okay. I can change. Sometimes I do Qigong, which I mentioned, that's one of my self-care practices. Sometimes I journal, sometimes I do exercise or yoga, and it's okay. as long as I spend about 5 minutes, give or take, quietly with myself in the morning before I start checking my phone and going on with my busy day, that's what matters. And well, the third thing I do is a practice of gratitude all day, just all day, finding gratitude.
That's awesome. And that reminds me that another one of our guests, Salomé Clouseau, the French sculptor, talked about how she has no routine, and that is her wellness practice, you know, and let's see what the day brings. So I think, to me, this is such an interesting question because different things work for different people. And I think sharing what works for them, others might listen and say, oh, that might work for me. I'm going to try that. And it's helpful that it's different for everyone. So thank you so much for joining. It's been so, such a pleasure, Jennifer. Do you want to just give people your website, your Instagram, your email one more time? And yeah, also any last words, you know, that you want to talk about the practice that you and Jen have put together with Meet Me or anything else?
Thank you so much. This has been an absolute pleasure. And I've loved listening to your podcast and watching that journey. You can find me on my website. It's meetmesolutions.com, or email is jennifer@meetmesolutions.com. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. It's Meet Me Find You.
Okay. And any last words?
My only last word is to quote one of my favorite authors, Jen Sincero. I want you to remember that you are amazing. The universe is totally freaking out about how amazing you are. So just go for it. And if you want to do coaching, see what it's all about. We would be so happy to jump on a call, just have a chat and see if it's the right fit for you. No pressure. This is a best friend vibe. So we're just really here to serve and help people feel amazing.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Love you too.
Thanks for joining On the Table with Ashley, where we'll meet individuals with thought-provoking perspectives from their varied life experiences and professions. On the Table will cover any topic you or I can put on the table with the goal of increasing curiosity, respect, and understanding while decreasing judgment, even when the issues discussed have sharp and contrasting viewpoints. On the Table also bridges to my company, Âme Attente, which has started with the goal of helping people connect more meaningfully through straightforward, skillfully made, bespoke home goods. Check us out at ameattende.com. That's ameattende.com, or on Instagram at ameattende. And if you have ideas for future podcast episodes, shoot us an email at reachoutanytime@ameattende.com. Thanks for listening.